This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Poetry Foundation, with a reminder that Chicago is the pulse of poetry. Visit the Poetry Foundation on the corner of Superior and Dearborn to explore their library of 40,000 books, attend public events, and view Frente a la Vida, Facing Life, a striking multidisciplinary art exhibition by Chicago artist Victoria Martinez. Learn more at poetryfoundation.org.
This is Reset. I'm Natalie Moore, in for Sasha Ann Simons. Shoot for the stars. Aim higher. Be the best. There's always room for improvement. We've all heard and said something along those lines in the continuous search to be better, the best, even perfect. But our guest today says her own journey has led her to ditch ideals of flawlessness and to embrace the messy. In her new book, Stop Waiting for Perfect, Chicago author L'Oreal Thompson Payton urges readers to readjust attitudes around perfection and to step out of their comfort zones and into their power. I start by asking if she describes herself as a perfectionist.
Absolutely. I'm a work in progress, and that's the whole point of it, right? I mean, there's no such thing as, like, I finally arrived and I'm finally over it and I've done all the things. I'm still learning and growing. It's just that I wrote a book about it and I'm sharing it all with you in real time, these lessons that I've come across as well.
When did you first realize you were a perfectionist? Was it something in adulthood, teenage years, or childhood?
All of the above. So I definitely was the straight A student. I was valedictorian in my eighth grade class. I always got the good report cards, perfect attendance awards, and all of the things. And I don't think I knew that there was necessarily something wrong with that until adulthood, until therapy, if we're being honest, because that's just the way that I was raised. I was conditioned as a Black woman. You have to work twice as hard to get half as much. And I really did live into that for a lot of my life until I figured out, you know, there's a softer and better way to do life instead.
Speaking of that, early on in the book, you make reference to a famous TV scene from the show Scandal.
Yes.
It's when Olivia Pope's father scolds her for, among other things, shooting for mediocrity. Let's take a listen.
Did I not raise you for better? How many times have I told you you have to be what? You have to be what?
Twice.
What?
Twice as good.
Twice as good as them to get half of what they have.
I remember that scene
in
real time vividly. Why did it resonate with you?
It finally put words to something I had felt all my life. I remember when I was interviewing for a summer camp in middle school, which are just words that I feel like shouldn't go together. And my mom had me and my sister dressed up in our Easter finest. I had, you know, the hosiery and the slip and everything like that to just be at 10 years old or whatever it was, like, present as I'm worthy enough and I deserve to be here, because it is so much harder for us than our white counterparts to make the case, rather, that we deserve a seat at this table as well, even as young as 10 years old in middle school interviewing for a summer camp. And when I heard that phrase, when I saw the scene, I was like, that's what it was. That's what my mom was doing. And of course, you know, like, that generation and generations before her, that's what they knew. That's how you got ahead. That's how you succeed in America. And what I'm trying to do now with this book is kind of teach future generations, current generations, previous generations, that we don't always have to be perfect in order to be worthy or be accepted. You are worthy as you are. You are enough as you are. You don't have to do the most, and you don't have to work twice as hard.
I grew up hearing you have to be twice as good. I didn't interpret it as perfection, though. To me, it was about, there's racism out here, so you're smart, but you can't be mediocre because of the way these structures are. Did your parents tell you have to be twice as good, or did that scene just click for you what they were trying to do?
They never said it outright, but I feel like it was certainly implied. And all of those things are certainly true. There's racism, there's sexism, there's all of these things. You look at like WeWork and Adam Neumann, and a black woman would never be able to fail as like stupendously as he has. And so there are a lot of barriers that are already out there against us. And I think there was an added layer for myself where I saw this as a survival mechanism. Like, okay, well, if I'm perfect, then that means I won't have to worry about failure. I'll be above reproach. I won't have to like do all of these messy things. I'll be untouchable. And that was not what I learned or found out to be true in my career and my life as well.
Where do you think your aim for perfectionism came from? I mean, you gave the middle school story, but mm-hmm. were you the kid who just always drew inside the lines and wanted things to be orderly?
Okay. Yeah, I still draw inside the lines. I mean, my mom's a Virgo, so I feel like maybe that's part of it. I mean, we know Beyonce's a Virgo as well, so there's some of those tendencies. But I think I just watched by learning from her, looking at her and what she was doing and how she got ahead in the world, how she navigated the world. And it just, as the kid getting the straight A's and everything like that, I saw that, okay, adults really like this. You know, like they're approving of me. This is a way to gain external validation. And I really leaned on that throughout a lot of my life instead of looking inward and deciding that, okay, you know, like you don't have to be the best. You don't have to strive for perfection because it's unhealthy. Like it's an unhealthy obsession. I write about crying when I lost my Peloton streak after 600.
Yeah, that was my next question. So let's go back. Let's talk about the Peloton. You opened the book with the Peloton story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I feel like is just it's a perfect, for lack of a better word, illustration of an unhealthy obsession with perfection. I got Peloton right before the pandemic, right before our multiple IVF cycles. This was something that I could control in a world that was literally falling apart around me. And I just became addicted to the blue dot that you get every time you complete a workout. And I was like, come hell or high water, like I did a guided meditation on the way to our C-section. Like that's not okay. And then like fast forward a month later, we're rushing around the doctor's appointments trying to get our daughter together and everything, and I realized I lost a streak and I cried real tears because it was like, okay, well, who am I without this streak? Like, who is L'Oreal? And what I realized after, again, shout out to therapy, is that I'm the same person. I'm still worthy of love. I'm enough as I am. I do not have to constantly strive to be the perfect daughter, wife, sister, mother, especially with motherhood, because it's like perfection and parenting do not go together. And that was kind of my crash course into that with losing the Peloton streak and just realizing, okay, like, it's the world is going to continue to spin. And it was kind of embarrassing, honestly, like to cry about that.
I don't have a Peloton bike, but I have the app on my phone. Mm-hmm. And it does reward you. 52-week streak,
yep.
Daily streak. I don't think I've gotten past 30 days. And recently I was up to 2 weeks and I folded on Sunday.
Yeah. And that's okay.
Yeah. But I think it feels like checking off a box so that you've committed to something and you're rewarded for it, even mm-hmm. though the only reward seeker
bragging
is,
rights.
It's right. Like I don't even tell other people. It was just for me. Who did you imagine you were talking to when you were writing this book?
Oh, I love that question. And I just put together a presentation where I literally included a picture of like 5-year-old L'Oreal. And so I think back to her and how she really just was like, I'm a good student, so I always have to be a good student. I want to be a good daughter. I want to be a good friend and sister, and put so much pressure on herself. And my mom always told me that. She was like, I don't know where you're getting this from. Like, no one else is putting this pressure on you, but I put it on myself. And so this book, Stop Waiting for Perfect, is a love letter to not only a younger me, but other perfectionists, other recovering perfectionists, other Black women and girls in particular, to just give them a hug in the form of a book and let them know that, hey, it's okay. You don't have to be perfect. But also for like the creatives out there, the other writers, that you don't have to wait for this perfect moment to launch the podcast, to write the book, to start the blog, whatever it is, this big idea that you have, that perfect moment is never going to come. So it's better to do it now, do it messy, and still put it out in the world.
You just talked about how motherhood and perfectionism do not go together.
No, ma'am, they do not.
I'm sure that you went into it thinking that it could, though.
Oh, yeah.
When did it click for you that this ain't it?
Very early on. I mean, I even remember getting the deadline for the first draft of the book, and it was like December or something, 2 months after my daughter was born. And I was like, I can do it. I can do it. While she naps. My agent was like, no, that's cute, but I'm going to stop you right now. And I just, you know, I used to be a very punctual person. And now, you know, you got to give us a 15, 20 minute grace period to get anywhere now, especially that she's a toddler and wants to do things on her own. And it's really forced me, someone who's very by the book and follows the rules and we have to do things in this particular way, to learn to go with the flow and also to extend myself some grace. I told a story recently where we were in Hawaii and hiking up the volcano Diamond Head, and I've done the hike before, no big deal, but very different with a 20-some pound toddler strapped to you, and I got tired. We didn't make it to the top, and I sat down and I turned around to her, and she was like a year old at the time, but I was like, Mommy's tired, and it's very important that we honor our body and our boundaries. And that's not something that I would have done 5-10 years ago. I would have pushed myself to the brink of exhaustion, to over the edge of exhaustion, to prove the point, to be perfect, to say that I completed the goal that I set out to do. And now I'm learning that there is an easier way to go about life and trying to pass that on to my daughter as well.
I'm also wondering where you see the line between not aiming for perfection, but aiming for progress, because people are ambitious. They want to start that podcast, that blog, the things that you said. So how do you navigate balance?
Listen, I had a vision of writing this book in a coffee shop window with the lo-fi hip-hop playing in the background and my oat milk latte in hand, and that happened maybe 2 or 3 times altogether, but a lot of this book was written in the Notes app at 2 a.m. while I was breastfeeding my daughter. I could not literally afford to wait for those perfect moments to sit down and do the thing. I had to find the time and kind of like borrow time in the margins of time, if you will. And I remember reading a tweet as I was finishing the first draft that talked about, you know, you can edit bad, but you can't edit nothing. So it's important that you put words on a paper or whatever it is, the project that you're trying to do, because you can always go back and edit it. You can make it better. You can tweak it, but you can't do that if there's nothing to begin with. And so it's more important that you start, that you feel the fear and you do it anyway. It is scary, but there's so much power and courage in doing things that make us afraid, because they make us better.
You talk pretty candidly about jealousy.
Oh, yeah.
And experiencing those feelings, especially when scrolling through social media. And people don't want to talk about jealousy, but I think you did dedicate a whole chapter.
Yes.
to it. Let's tell us about what was making you feel jealous and how people can work through that.
Yeah, so I'm a Scorpio, and I feel like that's one of our most famous traits is jealousy, passion, all of those things. And instead of hiding it and being ashamed of it, I wanted us to talk openly about it, because there is power in that, in naming our feelings and also not letting them own us. And so in talking directly to my friends, I remember a dear friend, shout out to Pam, she's listening, who published her book first. And I told her, I saw a greeting card afterward that was like, I'm 97% happy for you and 3% jealous. And it was important for me to be candid with her about that, because I wanted to show up, and she's created this space for me as a friend to show up as my full authentic self. But there's so much jealousy that's out there. You know, we all compare our behind the scenes to everyone else's highlight reel, which is all social media really is. And it can be a little discouraging when you see someone else out there doing your goals, or they get to the goal before you do. And I've muted people on social media. I'm not afraid to admit that, especially when we, again, were going through our IVF journey and it seemed like everyone else around me was pregnant. I had to mute certain people in order to protect my peace, and that's okay. I think we're also ashamed to not be happy for everyone all the time, but you don't have to. Like, it's okay. You need to put your mental health first and make that a priority, and then just kind of keep your, you know, your blinders on and keep your eyes on your own paper. I remember the I forget which Olympics it was, but I'm a native Marylander, even though I've been in Chicago for 10 years. And Michael Phelps was swimming, and there was another swimmer, and there was a picture, and he like turns to look at Michael, and Michael ends up winning the race by like whatever fraction of a second. And I think of that, I'm like, I wonder if turning and looking at your competition cost this guy the race. And I think that's true in life as well. If we just keep our eyes on our own paper, we can, you know, smile, clap, applaud, like everyone else's status, but not compare ourselves to them and their wins, because we don't know what's going on and they're behind the scenes as well.
How did your friend Pam take getting that card saying 3% jealous? Because I wonder if sometimes we just have to keep our, like, normalize our feelings, but do we have to always share those feelings? Can they be negative on the people we love?
I think it depends. You know, you have to gauge the situation in your friendship as well. We're very honest with each other about what we're going through and also understand each other on a certain level because we're both writers, because we're both creative. So we felt those feelings, if not directed toward each other, other people as well. And so it was helpful for me to know that, okay, I don't have to be perfect in this moment. I don't have to put on the smile and be like, oh my gosh, I'm so happy for you, because I am. And I'm also feeling some sense of jealousy. And both of those things are okay. Chelsea Jackson Roberts, Peloton instructor.
I do her yoga.
She is amazing. I met her on Sunday. Well, I met her before, but I did her class this past Sunday when I was in New York. And she talks a lot about the both and, how two things can be true at once. And so you can hold both of those things at the same time, like happiness for this person, and you're really excited to see them reach their goal. And it can also bring up some icky feelings for you about what you have yet to accomplish. And that's okay. We don't have to pretend to be perfect and be happy all the time. I think we do ourselves a disservice by like squashing down those less popular emotions, if you will.
On the flip side, what does self-sabotage look like?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it is keeping your book proposal in your Google Drive for years on end, like I did before I finally mustered up the courage to start querying literary agents and putting myself out there in terms of writing this actual book. But I think sometimes, you know, and I talk in there as well about different types of fear. There's fear of failure, but I am someone, and I think other people can relate to it as well, this fear of success. You know, like we're almost intimidated by what could happen if we do put the thing out there and make ourselves, you know, known and really stand in our shine. And that can be scary as well. And all of those emotions, I work with my therapist. We use a feelings wheel very often where I'll go through and be like, yes, I'm feeling anxious, overwhelmed, stressed, and just naming those and trying to figure out where is that coming from? What is the truth? What's real? And what's just like noise or my inner critic being loud is a really helpful exercise for me.
And speaking of that, tell us who Negative Nancy is.
Negative Nancy. She's been making the rounds lately. This is my inner critic. I named her such because I love alliteration. And what I found, though, in naming the inner critic, because we all have that voice in our heads, whether it's our voice, our moms, our partner, a friend, or someone who is telling you, you can't do that, you're not good enough. It's not true. This critic, this inner critic, this negative self-talk that we hear a lot of times is honestly just trying to keep us safe. It's trying to keep us protected. It's trying to keep us in that comfort zone. But we all know that that's not where the magic is. And so it's kind of turning to your negative Nancy or whoever your inner critic is and telling them, okay, I got this. Okay, I need you to have a seat, get in the back seat, but I'm in the driver's seat now, and I'm going to be in control of this journey. And it's not about like, okay, overcoming it one and done and you're, you know, better and go on with the rest of your life. I find in those moments where you're putting yourself out there that she tends to pop up, and it's just kind of like, okay, I know you're here with me right now, but I'm going to push forward anyway and go forth and do the things.
Does leaving your comfort zone help you be a perfectionist, or does it help you shed some of those ideals around perfectionism?
It's helped me so far shed some of the ideals around perfectionism. Earlier this week, I was on CBS Mornings. I have never done national TV.
We heard
before.
About that over here at WBEZ.
I was so nervous, so anxious, and it went by so fast. And I still haven't watched the recording because I know that I'm my own worst critic. And so I'm kind of waiting to do that. But having done it, I was like, okay, I did a really scary thing. And the world kept spinning. I didn't die. Like, it was okay. And so, okay, like, courage is a muscle. The more we do scary things, the easier they become. And I'm, you know, in the book trying to tell people, like, imposter syndrome, I feel like, has gotten a bad rap, and perfectionism, all these sort of things. And what I found, at least with imposter syndrome, is, like, if I'm leveling up in my career and my life, then imposter syndrome is going to pop up occasionally. And that's okay, because it means that I'm doing something scary. I'm stepping out of my comfort zone, and this is just going to be a part of the journey. But instead of letting it overcome me and stop me in my tracks and tell me that, okay, you know, like, you're not good enough, it's like, okay, that maybe could have gone a little better, but I did it, and I'll know what to do for next time.
The book is marketed on the back as like a pocket-sized pep talk to people. And at the end of each chapter, you have reflection questions. questions. Is that something that you always wanted to include when you were thinking about this book? Why did you add those?
I wanted to make it more interactive, that this is something I have books that I will go to in times of need. I think of Elizabeth Gilbert's Big Magic. I reread every year at the beginning of the year. And so I want Stop Waiting for Perfect to be that for someone else. I want it to be a book that you pick up when you're getting ready for a speaking engagement, a job interview, making the case for your promotion, or whatever scary goal it is that you have ahead of you, and these questions to revisit because your answers may change. But I didn't want it just be a book you read and you put back on your shelf. I want people to take notes. I want you to underline. I want you to highlight. I want it to be messy and imperfect, and I want it to be with you and carry you through those difficult parts of life.
Do perfectionists have a hard time asking for help?
Absolutely. I write in the book a very vivid scene. My husband had gone to a networking event, and I was in charge of bedtime routine with the baby. Usually he does it after I finish nursing her. And in my head, I was like, okay, I can do this. This is easy. Like, she's your daughter, of course. And long story short, he came home and found both me and her crying because I was overwhelmed. I think she could sense my panic of like, and not going to sleep.
Putting me to bed?
Right. Like, what are you doing? You are not my dad. Like, she was not about that life. And after he got home and got both of us situated, I texted my friend. I was like, Dory, I don't think I'm cut out for this mom life. And she was like, well, A, it's too late. And B, yes, you are. And the next day I went on Instagram stories, and it was more of a rant, but also came across as kind of like this cry for help. Just telling you that parenting is really hard. It's a lot harder than I thought it would be. It's butting up against everything I've known about perfectionism and how to move about life. And immediately two friends DM'd me and were like, do you need me to babysit? Can I come over? Do you need me to watch the baby? And so that really forced me to accept help. What I'm working on now is proactively asking for it before it gets to a breaking point. But perfectionism tells you, okay, you not only have to do everything, you have to do it on your own. You can't ask for help. That's a sign of weakness. And I'm unlearning all of that and learning to ask for help as well.
How do you keep the perfectionism in check today? This book is out. I mean, you're on CBS this morning. You're hitting your markers of success. Is that, how's that making you feel?
Overwhelmed. And I had to reevaluate my goals a little bit. My friend Taylor Morrison, a fellow author who I'm going to be in conversation with tomorrow at Women and Children First tomorrow evening, if anyone wants to stop by.
What time?
That's a great question. I think it's 6 p.m. It might be 7, though. I should really know this.
We'll tweet that.
Make
out.
A note. Okay.
Or you can go on Women and Children First website to find that.
Exactly. And earlier this year, her book came out and she shared some more qualitative goals than quantitative. And so it was talking about, I want to be, you know, help people with this book. I wanted to do well enough that I'm able then to write a second book. And I made my goal is like, I want to help at least one person. I just need to know that it's touched one person and helped one person. And earlier this week in New York at an event, there was a young Black girl who was like, oh my gosh, I see myself in you. And that just like full circle moment made me feel like, okay, if nothing else goes well, at least I did that.
That Chicago author, L'Oreal Thompson Payton, her debut book, Stop Waiting for Perfect, Step Out of Your Comfort Zone and Into Your Power, is out now. L'Oreal, congratulations on the new book and thanks for stopping by.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
This episode of Reset was produced by me and Meha Ahmad and edited by Brenda Ruiz. Get the news, politics, and culture happening in Chicago by subscribing to our podcast. We post episodes every morning and afternoon, Monday through Friday, with a bonus episode of Something Fun on Saturdays. That'll do it for Reset. I'm Natalie Moore, and for Sasha Ann Simons, we'll talk to you this afternoon.